From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Throughout his long papacy, Pope John Paul II reached out to the world. Today in Rome, the world reached out once more to him. After an open-air mass in St. Peter's Square that drew together political leaders and humble pilgrims, the Pope was laid to rest under the Vatican's great basilica. In his lifetime, this complex, charismatic Pope was a powerful thinker, symbol, and star. Now, in death, it seems that everyone wants to make his aura their own, to claim his teaching as their inspiration. This hour, we're stepping back from the extraordinary events of the past week to explore the core of the Pope's message. Tonight on Point, author, essayist, former priest, and Catholic thinker James Carroll on the heart of the legacy of Pope John Paul II. We begin tonight in Rome with a perspective on the day's historic events. Alan Cooperman is religion correspondent for The Washington Post. I asked him to paint a picture of the scene today at Vatican City.
I was in the middle of the crowd about 20 yards in front of the big obelisk in the center of St. Peter's Square, surrounded by a mass, a very variegated mass of pilgrims from around the world, Italian papa's boys or Pope-loving teenagers, Bosnian nuns, all kinds of people from all the world, all ages, all brought together for the funeral. It was very moving.
What was the mood among the people that surrounded you there on the piazza at the Vatican?
You know, at times during the funeral, clearly people were very somber. I saw a lot of tears. But I was also struck by the number of faces that seemed radiant to me, the number of people who seemed happy, not laughing, but so happy to be there, so happy to be seeing that moment. And sometimes I stood there and talked with people. I watched before my eyes as they moved between tears and radiance.
The sermon given today there by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger of Germany, what was its message, Alan?
Well, the sermon was really a eulogy to the Pope. It described the Pope's life. It was given in Italian, and many people in the crowd, myself included, did not understand it until we read a text later. The sort of Pope watchers among us have been ready to scrutinize this eulogy for clues about Cardinal Ratzinger's agenda for the Church or his thoughts about who should be the next Pope. This is a time-honored and very delicate way of doing things in the Vatican, signaling through very kind of tea-leaf-type signals what people think. It was difficult to find much in this sermon. I think one could maybe see one or two indications of maybe what Cardinal Ratzinger thinks, but it wasn't as overt as some eulogies in the past have been in trying to prognosticate or set agendas.
And from what we've read here, very personal in many ways, talking about the early death of his mother, talking about events from the Pope's life, as in any funeral.
I think that that's true. It was obviously a eulogy about the Pope. I also think it was very personal in the sense that Cardinal Ratzinger is someone who knew this Pope extremely well. This Pope made Ratzinger a bishop, made him an archbishop, made him a cardinal, brought him to Rome as essentially the Church's chief theologian. So it was a eulogy, if you will, given by the best friend in the Church. Maybe not the best friend in the world of the Pope, but certainly one of his very closest colleagues in the Church. And I guess that was appropriate. It would be like anybody's funeral. That would be appropriate.
By this point, most of us have seen images of the plain cypress coffin marked with the cross and the M for Mary. Can you describe the moment for us at the end of these ceremonies, or near the end, when the bells of St. Peter's tolled and those 12 pallbearers picked that coffin up and took it back into the basilica?
Yes, it was a most extraordinary moment. And if you remember, they didn't just pick it up and carry it in. They picked it up and they turned it around. It had been facing the altar and they turned it around so it faced the crowd. It faced the people, the flock, one more time. And there was a moment, a pause, as people watched that happening and weren't sure exactly why the pallbearers were moving the way they did. And then everybody understood. And the shouts erupted among the crowd. The people around me were rhythmically clapping and chanting, Giovanni Paolo, Giovanni Paolo, John Paul, and others were crying, santo subito, immediate sainthood, or sainthood now, or sainthood at last. I'm not sure how to translate it, but santo subito. And it was really amazing. I'm told that inside the cathedral there was also an amazing moment. As casket was brought in, the cardinals tell me that they lined up in a kind of guard of honor and fell absolutely silent and tipped their red zucchetti, their red hats, as the Pope's casket was borne by them and went into the crypt.
Alan, it's been described as the largest papal funeral in the Church's 2,000-year history. I guess in some ways that's not a surprise, given that we're now in an age of global media, global transportation, and then this, a very charismatic Pope. In that sea of people today, there'd been a lot of anticipation of the dignitaries there, presidents and kings and queens. Did the dignitaries make much of an imprint in that sea of humanity?
Well, if you were in the sea of humanity, as I was, the dignitaries didn't much matter. They seemed to be up there on some part of the stage, if you will, some part of the steps of St. Peter's, and not the center of attention, which was the altar and the procession, and to some extent the choir, which was singing quite beautifully. The dignitaries were just sitting there in black. They were pretty unnoticeable. There were a handful of colorful ones, maybe more impressive just from a viewer's perspective. There in the square was the panoply of religious leaders, from the Archbishop of Canterbury to various people who were Hindus and Sikhs looked like rabbis and imams, and the whole panoply there. And that was kind of moving. And up on the balcony, one could see what I believe were members of the Pope's personal household. The Polish nuns who took care of him were up on a high balcony away from the crowd. They had a Polish flag and a Solidarity flag among them, so they probably had some Polish visitors.
And now Rome cleans up and empties out some of that enormous crowd. The cardinals will enter conclave on April 18th. What happens institutionally between now and then, Alan?
The Church is run institutionally by the Camerlengo, or Chamberlain, who plays a key role, and by the cardinals. But in fact, the rules call for them to not make any important decisions that can be put off until the next pope. So they don't appoint bishops at this time or deal with issues of doctrine or anything like that. They just keep the machinery of the Church running for a couple weeks and wait for the election of the new pope.
A majestic and moving day in Rome. Alan Cooperman, thank you very much for joining us.
Very glad to be with you.
Alan Cooperman is religion correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with me from Rome. We are talking this hour about the core of Pope John Paul II's message with author, essayist, and former priest James Carroll. You can join the conversation. Were you plugged in to Rome today, following the funeral, the crowds, the resonance, even in death, of John Paul II? And beyond the charisma, warmth, and powerful aura, what does this Pope's message come down to for you? What will be his lasting legacy? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is James Carroll, columnist for the Boston Globe, former Catholic priest, and author of Constantine's Sword, The Church and the Jews, A History, and also Crusades, Chronicles of an Unjust War. His essay, The Pope's True Revolution, appears in the current issue of Time magazine. James Carroll, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
So you must have been watching today.
Not as much as I would like to have, actually, but I was fully aware of it all day long, and it's a momentous day.
You must have seen, as we have, that in the week since the Pope's death, nearly a week now, everybody seems to be, this is putting it too lightly, but the Pope's best friend, the reflection of the Pope. All leaders are now saying, yes, the Pope speaks for me, and by inference, I kind of carry the Pope's message. But surely, as large a figure as this Pope was, his message doesn't endorse every agenda on this planet.
Well, it's true. I mean, at one level, it speaks to the breadth of his influence that so many people seek to identify with him, and let's face it, also seek to wrap themselves in the mantle of his greatness and hope that some of it will rub off on them. Although I have to admit that many people wind up looking pretty small doing it. So there's that, but there is also this, he was a rare human being, and he had rare effect on history. It's very unusual. I mean, we've become pretty sophisticated in our notions of how history is the consequence of movements, forces, most of them impersonal and most of them beyond identification. We've stopped believing in the great man theory of history. Actually, we have here a great man who has really moved history. And, of course, the fact that so many people with such widely varied ideologies and commitments recognize him speaks also to a certain complication, if not inconsistency, in what he stood for. So that's part of the legacy, too. And I think we'll spend a lot of time sorting out the significance, finally, of John Paul II, this powerful, sweeping tsunami of feeling and appreciation today now has to undergo a certain test of history as we look back and parse the full meaning of who this man was.
We've just got a minute before a break here, but you write that in the end it comes down to two things that are most likely to be seen as big hinges when we look back on this, and that is endorsing a change in the church's view of war, basically ruling it out as a tool.
Yes.
And mending the Catholic Church's long bad relationship with the Jewish people.
By far the two most significant pieces of his legacy, without question.
And interestingly, you say that in each of these there are seeds of much greater change than Pope John Paul II himself might have imagined or might have wanted.
John Paul II is the beginning of major change, not the end of it.
We're going to come back and really dive in here. We're talking tonight with essayist, novelist, author, former priest, big Catholic thinker James Carroll about the core of the legacy of Pope John Paul II. You can join us tonight. Beyond the charisma and warmth and powerful aura, what does this Pope's message come down to for you? What's the hard diamond of his legacy at the center of it all? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight on the day of the Pope's funeral with essayist, author, former priest, and big Catholic thinker James Carroll about the core of the legacy of Pope John Paul II. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you see? Is everyone trying now already to claim the Pope's mantle as their own? Could John Paul's core message get lost in the scramble to claim his legacy? How do you see the heart of the legacy of this Pope? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. James Carroll, you in your essay in Time magazine, you come right at us and you say you probably think that this is a conservative Pope, a Catholic traditionalist, that he'll be remembered above all for shoring up structures of the past, and you say all that is wrong. Well, that does kind of come as an arresting observation. Why not those things?
Well, the two points I make is that John Paul II brought to maturity and completion movements that were underway already when he became Pope. One in relationship to the idea of, as the Church puts it, coercion in defense of truth, which is the core of the just war theory. It's also been the core down through the centuries of terrible acts of violence in the name of higher causes, just causes. It's a central principle in the just war theory. In Dignitatis Humanae, the momentous declaration of the Second Vatican Council of 1965,
Vatican II,
the Church formally renounces the use of coercion for the use of force. And this document is commonly known as the Declaration on Religious Liberty. It affirmed the right of the individual to make his or her own choices of conscience. It affirmed basic democratic ideas like the separation of church and state. It was understood as a kind of triumph of American understandings of democracy. Mm. It's the Church's repudiation of its own rejection of democracy. But most importantly, it was a profound repudiation of the idea of coercion and force as a way of advancing good causes.
You trace that all the way back to 1095, Urban II calling for the Crusades.
The Crusades were the ultimate holy war. Mm-hmm. This is very relevant for the public discussion in our time because there are a lot of people out there on all kinds of different bases trying to make the case for a justifiable holy war.
And, of course, it goes back earlier than Urban to Constantine.
Yes,
indeed
it does. Mm-hmm. Constantine is the beginning of this tradition, Christianity. Urban II sacralized violence. The Crusades were the first time that violence was regarded as a sacred act for which you could go to heaven. And the great slogan was, God wills it. Well, the point I'm trying to make here is that that tradition was firmly repudiated with the Second Vatican Council. Pope Paul VI, John Paul II's predecessor by two, within weeks of the declaration, Dignitatis Humanae, on the dignity of the human person, went before the United Nations, gave that stirring speech, October of 1965, the climax of which was his saying at the top of his voice, no more war, war never again.
No asterisks, no subclauses.
And this was not abstraction. This was at the absolute beginning of Lyndon Johnson's war in Vietnam, and everyone in the United Nations General Assembly understood that the Pope of the Catholic Church in the United States of America was repudiating the new American war.
But of course, what's happening here is this Pope, John Paul II, is described again and again now as pushing back against Vatican II. I see his image, the robust kind of muscular-looking Catholic,
yes,
being deployed,
well,
against
true,
the message of Vatican II. But you make the case that, in fact, first just take this point on war,
that
he pushed it forward. How?
And let me just, yes, so we come to John Paul II, and of course, one of the shorthand signals of his greatness, often referred to this week, was his role in the downfall of communism.
Mm-hmm.
But we've missed the most important point about the way he accomplished that. When the Reagan administration and all of its totalitarian school experts on Marxism and communism recognized the Contras in Central America as the great force with which to ally ourselves in the combat against the Soviet Union.
And flooded arms to them.
At that very moment, the Reagan administration is ignoring, barely even notices, this movement in Poland called Solidarity. The only support that in 1980, 1981, 1982, the only support of significance that Solidarity receives is from the Vatican and the person of John Paul II. Lech Walesa, who's a man, who's a fugitive, who's a man with a price on his head, who's a prisoner.
And not about arms.
It's not about arms. And one of the things to be aware of is that Lech Walesa and the leaders of Solidarity have already picked up on the tradition of Gandhi, Martin Luther King, nonviolent resistance. Of course, it's a very pragmatic decision to be made at when you're talking about the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
John Paul II's affirmation of Solidarity was an explicit affirmation of nonviolent power, not coercion in the name of truth, but belief in the power of the truth itself. Now, why is this important? This goes to the argument that was the great argument of the 20th century between people who again and again invested in war, believed in war, thought of war as the last resort necessary, but against those who, the simplistic idealists, as they were often regarded, who insisted that no, war is not the way to do this, that nonviolent resistance can be powerful.
This is Gandhi and Martin Luther King against all the forces of
John
war.
John Paul II against the Reagan administration throws all of the weight of his influence behind a firm act of resistance to Soviet tyranny that is openly and overtly nonviolent. And because he does, when the opening comes with the arrival of Gorbachev, Gorbachev would have had no choice but to respond to resistance and revolution within the Soviet Empire violently.
Armed resistance, yes.
He would have had no choice but to respond to it violently if that resistance had been violent, had even had a whiff of violence about it. But Solidarity and then the Velvet Revolution of Czechoslovakia, the various movements in East Germany, Hungary, the movements that spread across the Soviet Empire into the Soviet Union itself with the refusenik movements, the various dissidents, all of them embracing nonviolence with the support of this Pope. And it was, of course, triumphant. Now, let me just draw your attention to one quick ironic moment, the great moment of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the moment when this movement finally takes the United States government entirely by surprise. They don't have a clue.
It's coming down and there hasn't been a shot fired.
Of how powerful this is. It's a violation of all of the orthodoxies of the Soviet experts in the United States of America. November of 1989, the wall comes down. What happens within weeks? What is the American response to this arrival of the nonviolent moment? It's the invasion of Panama, which takes place 3 weeks later.
Opportunity.
A stunning, absolutely stunning repudiation of the meaning of the historic moment. a foolish, unjustified, illegal invasion of Panama, which the Pope instantly repudiated.
And walk us through
And then
the
let's just remember other, yes. that every time the United States sent troops or bombers abroad, six, seven, eight times since then, the Vatican, John Paul II himself, explicitly in opposition. The first Gulf War, the NATO campaign against Serbia, certainly the second Gulf War, even the so-called war on terrorism, and this grotesque war that we have launched in Iraq. President Bush is paying tribute to John Paul II without any blush at the way in which John Paul II repudiated, and repudiated again two or three of the most precious principles of President Bush's style of governance. Not only this war, but his attachment, his personal attachment to the death penalty. It's really, one must really object.
Pope John Paul II, with him and with Vatican II, is there really no more room for just war? And in Catholic teaching, does this stick?
Well, in Catholic teaching now, we recognize a kind of new sense of what you might call firm options for or against. The word option comes into the language of Catholic morality powerfully with the Latin American bishops in the late 60s who mm-hmm. talked about the preferential option for the poor. Mm-hmm. In class conflict, the church is not going to accept a Marxist or a capitalist analysis, but is instinctively prepared to make a preferential option for the poor. In a similar way, the church has a preferential option in favor of life and a preferential option against war. I wouldn't say that the church has joined the Quakers in becoming a pacifist movement. I wouldn't say that, and that's not what this means. But what it does mean is, especially in the age of weapons of mass destruction, in almost all conceivable circumstances, war is to be opposed. War makes things worse, not better.
President Bush, returning from Italy today on Air Force One, and the news reports are coming out even as he flies, the president has been effusive in his praise of Pope John Paul II, saying today that being at the funeral was one of the highlights of his presidency. He said, "I think John Paul II will have a clear legacy of peace, compassion, and a strong legacy of setting a clear moral tone." He said that as he viewed the Pope's body, he felt very much at peace. He was very personal today, President Bush, much more in touch with his spirit. And he was talking today on Air Force One about his strengthened belief in a living God. In practice, how closely lining up with Pope John Paul's teaching, how not?
Well, you know, one recognizes language like that from President Bush as the language that the so-called hardcore realist are inclined to use about people that they can admire but effectively condescend to, the idealist. Thank God we have these idealists around who can represent the better way to us. This is the way Churchill talked about Gandhi, not thinking for a moment that Gandhi had anything serious to say about world politics. Churchill learned to his chagrin that he had underestimated Gandhi's power. And I would say in a similar way, it would be a big mistake to dismiss John Paul II as a, quote, man of peace, unquote, as if he isn't a profoundly attuned, realistic man of affairs, a worldly man who understands how power is exercised and how power is to be challenged. The record of John Paul II's manipulations of power through the 1980s, his participation, quiet at times, overt at other times. Mm. One time, for example, he goes to Poland. Lech Walesa is not allowed to see him. Mm. Lech Walesa is in custody. John Paul II refused to accept the government's forbidding Lech Walesa to see him. He insisted on it.
Bring him to me.
And that act of insistence was itself powerful. He understood what the government of Poland had to do, what it could do. He didn't make demands that couldn't be met. I mean, it was a very sly and sophisticated use of realistic power.
But all that
always,
wrapped
always,
around a rejection
always,
of war, a non-violent
always on the ground,
approach.
Always on the ground of understanding that the moment violence is invoked, all is lost. There was and of course, this goes to his radical suspicion, and I didn't agree with his assessment here, but his radical suspicion of so-called liberation theology, because of there was certain confusion in the 80s, 70s, and 80s about the relationship between liberation theology and violent revolution.
Mm. He equated it with an onset of communism.
Well, yes, he did, and he didn't actually make distinctions that people who were closer to the movement were quite capable of making, which is that most liberation theologians and most people of the liberation movement in the church in Latin America were not themselves attached to violence. They were, in fact, the alternative to violence. But it was... The point I'm making here is that he was so suspicious of violence, so prepared to turn away from it, that I think that was part of what accounted for his actually missing the important power of liberation theology in Latin America.
We're talking tonight with James Carroll, author, essayist, columnist for the Boston Globe, former priest himself. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I want to turn to the second great fork that you see, or the second great... river of his legacy here, and that is in the Catholic Church's relationship with the Jews, the Jewish people. Consequential in itself, and you write, you say, opens up a door to religious tolerance that had never quite been opened in this way before.
It's true. Now, John Paul II is commonly acknowledged as a pope who was a tremendous and path-breaking reconciler with other religions generally, certainly with Eastern Orthodoxy, not so with the Anglican tradition, where the question of women's ordination was a terrible obstacle.
But the first pope in history to visit a synagogue.
But he's commonly saluted for his breakthroughs with the Jewish people. My point is that we don't go deeply enough in this discussion to what he really did, beginning again with the Second Vatican Council. Mm. The doctrine, the document there, well known to Catholics and Jews, perhaps not so well known elsewhere, Nostra Aetate, in our time, again 1965, a document that did two things about the Church's relationship to the Jewish people. Number one, it repudiated once and for all the myth, the slander that the Jews as a people are guilty of the murder of Christ. Mm-hmm. But even as equally, and that's, of course, the seed of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And secondly, equally important, Nostra Aetate affirms, and this is, I can't emphasize this enough, affirms the full, complete, and permanent integrity of the covenant that God has made with Israel. The integrity of Jewish religion, that is, of ongoing Jewish religion. Jewish religion is not superseded by Christianity, as the Church had taught for almost 2,000 years. The Church has not, quote, replaced Judaism. And not only that, the covenant that God has made with Israel is Israel's way of being with God.
This is radical. This is 2,000 years pushed aside.
This is not about Jesus. This is about the covenant. What we have here is the seed. It isn't fully developed yet. It's an assertion that will be leading to I would predict, a new theology of the Church's relationship, not only to Jews and the Jewish people, but to other people.
Because, ecumenicalism.
Yes, indeed. It's the principle of pluralist respect for religions that claim other ways to God.
And how new is this in the Catholic tradition?
Well, in relationship to the Jewish people, it's revolutionary. And lest one think I'm making too much of this or that... this is about Nostra Aetate, not John Paul II. Mm. This is the ground of John Paul II's movement to heal the breach with the Jewish people, motivated, obviously, and of course, by his close experience of the Holocaust. Mm. This is an ethical change in theology that is grounded in an ethical insight that the Holocaust is a horror that required the Church to understand where it came from. But more basic than civility or friendliness or kindness to the Jewish people is a repudiation of the idea that the Church has replaced Judaism. Now, John Paul II...
Will that stick?
Well, Yes, it's sticking already. You can see it sticking. For example,
2,000 years of history and thinking is long.
The American Catholic bishops have formally said that the church is not to proselytize among the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Jim Scales, stand by. We're going to take a short break here. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight with essayist, author, former priest, big Catholic thinker, James Carroll, about the core of the legacy of Pope John Paul II. James Carroll sees the heart of it all in the rejection of war and reconciliation with the Jews. Does that square with your summing up of John Paul II? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the core of the legacy of Pope John Paul II with essayist, author, former priest, big Catholic thinker, James Carroll. You can join us tonight as well. How are you sorting through the complexities of this long-lived pope? And has this traditional pope set the stage for radical change? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Herb is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Herb. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think there's one aspect of John Paul's reign that has been overlooked, and that is that I believe he was a catalyst between Reagan and Gorbachev to persuade Mikhail Gorbachev and the Stavka, the Soviet General Staff, that they could begin the process of disarmament without risk of falling victim to the West. And I don't think that's generally appreciated, a confidence building within the top levels of the Soviet government.
You're describing him as a go-between, or are you saying that it was Reagan's big stick was important while the Pope talked peace?
I think he kind of acted as a catalyst because the Solidarity movement had been well advanced by the time that, the late 80s, that a normalization, I guess you could call it a normalization of relations, and this terrible threat of the tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. I never thought I'd see it in my lifetime.
And yet we did.
I mean, having been through the Bay of Pigs and then the Pueblo crisis when we went to the brink twice, and there are other times that weren't as severe, but there certainly were a great cause for concern.
And then suddenly the breakthrough, and we're on the other side of that. Herb, thank you very much for your call. James Carroll, the Pope as a go-between, do you see him in that kind of practical role? Or?
Well, the hagiography of Ronald Reagan wants to make them intimate partners. I don't believe that.
A kind of dynamic duo.
Yeah, I don't believe that's true, although the greatness of Ronald Reagan was in his capacity to respond positively to Mikhail Gorbachev. And I made a point earlier that I think Mikhail Gorbachev was in a position to respond peacefully and creatively to the challenge of the collapsing Soviet Union, in part because of what had been put in place by the nonviolent resistance throughout the Soviet Empire, and John Paul II was a key piece of that. Now, having said all of that, I think it's very important to understand the beginning in 1989, if one can claim any kind of partnership between the Pope and the American president, it ends there. The caller just referred to the dreadful problem of nuclear weapons and the nuclear arms race. Because the United States of America refused to understand that the Cold War was effectively ended by Mikhail Gorbachev and those who enabled him to do that, including John Paul II, we in a very triumphalist way declared that we had won the Cold War. President George H.W. Bush said so in a State of the Union address in 1991, in January. And the American conventional wisdom, we won the Cold War.
And we won it by building up our arms.
By building up our arms. We completely missed the point of how the Cold War ended. And one of the things that, why is that important? It's because it was in that period of the mid-90s that we stopped taking seriously the threat of nuclear weapons, the threat of the existing nuclear arsenals, and we were the ones who effectively stopped the dramatic downturn of nuclear weapons that Gorbachev and Reagan had begun. Remember that Reagan and George H.W. Bush cut the American nuclear arsenal more or less in half, and that's almost where it stands today. We have had very few cuts since then. And John Paul II stood against that American perception and against that American policy with every fiber of his being. So we have to be very careful in claiming that it was Reagan and John Paul, that John Paul II was on America's side at that denouement. No, I think it's much more complicated than that. And if there was any partnership implicit, not explicit, it was, you know, in John, as to repeat, in John Paul II's sponsorship, powerful sponsorship of a nonviolent, a powerful nonviolent resolution to the Cold War.
Which gave Gorbachev a way forward. Mary Beth is calling from Hudson, Massachusetts. Mary Beth, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering if Mr. Carroll could speak to this, the fact that this great man could not come to terms with a woman's equality and also a woman's right to choose her own destiny with her own body.
Well, of course, you put your finger on the great failure of John Paul II's pontificate. It's a mystery to me, frankly. It strikes me. I'm a feminist. I think feminists understand the self-evidence of the proper demand of women for equal treatment in all spheres. And the fact that the Roman Catholic Church has set its face so powerfully against feminism, the feminist insight against women, therefore, is a scandal. It's a sin. I've been talking here about the positive legacy of John Paul II.
Right.
And that's at the absolute top of the negative legacy. And it's going to be a damaging legacy. But in the short term or long term, it won't stand. The Roman Catholic Church is not going to successfully be the only institution on the planet Earth that exempts itself from the rising and continuing revolution of women's demands for full equality and justice.
Mary Beth, what's your experience of that piece of the legacy?
Raised in an Irish Catholic household in Massachusetts and spent 12 years with the Sisters of Notre Dame, and never brought my Catholicism into my adult life for those very reasons.
Because
and did not raise my children in the church either, because of the inequality. What I think of as an extreme, violent view of women, and I'm hoping that there might be some writings that we will find that will give us some insight into this his thinking.
Mary Beth, we hear it, and we're grateful for your call. Thank you very much for calling in tonight. Rachel's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Rachel. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I would also like to touch on a couple of negative aspects of the Pope's term on his clergy, or whatever you'd like to say. My first question is, or like to hear some discussion of the fact that he was anti-birth control, most importantly, anti-condom, when he had a huge following, or still does, I'm sure, in Africa,
yes,
where people are dying every day of AIDS. Secondly, I would like to hear some discussion on the fact that he protected or was willing to protect known child molesters if they were clergy members. And lastly, I would also like to hear what anybody thinks about the fact that he was so anti-gay right up until the end.
We'll pick them up, Rachel, and thanks for your call, James Carroll. There's the angry side of the
yes,
ledger.
Yes, it's true, and each of those points, Rachel's exactly right on to draw our attention to each of those points, and it would be an incomplete discussion if we didn't acknowledge the fact that the Roman Catholic Church is, well, in its position on birth control. One of the consequences of that, of course, is that the Roman Catholic Church is enabling and causing large numbers of abortion, to put it most directly. It is abetting the spread of AIDS, which is an appalling crime. And its offense against gay people, similarly, an appalling crime. But having said all that, let me just say that Roman Catholicism is in the middle of a sweeping social, cultural, and theological revolution. It was building through much of the 20th century. It reached a kind of climax with the Second Vatican Council. The affirmation that I referred to earlier in Dignitatis Humanae on the dignity of the human person, that document, that declaration includes the affirmation of the primacy of conscience. And it's the charter of Catholic dissent. The bishops of the council thought they were addressing the primacy of freedom of conscience of non-Catholics, but they couldn't affirm the primacy of conscience for non-Catholics without Catholics getting the point, too.
But though you're reaching back before this Pope.
Yes, so, it's true. But so, I want to affirm the importance of Catholic dissent on these issues. This Pope was desperate to protect a kind of medieval notion of Roman Catholicism, anti-democratic, anti-woman, anti-sexuality, anti-sex, many deeply neurotic strains in that tradition that this Pope was part of protecting.
Is that not a course change?
Well, it's true.
It's such a long papacy, such a powerful Pope.
Well, it's true. This was a very negative thing. But powerful at the same time is the claiming by the Catholic people of the right to conscience, the right to challenge these positions. And certainly most Catholics I know or know of act on these questions based on as much on conscience as they do on church teaching. Gay people who demand their place in the church, women who demand their place in the church, and I would also say gay people, women, others who are in dissent, who make their position on the church known by leaving it. I would include that as an act of conscience. So all I'm saying is that John Paul II, his negative legacies on these things is not going to dominate the future of the church, in my view, not in any way comparable to the important changes having to do with the Jewish people, war and peace.
I just have to ask you on that front then, are you, James Carroll, picking and choosing from this large, complex legacy? You know, we sort of opened the show saying people are wrapping the Pope's mantle around their own take of the world and spirituality, religion, what's right.
Mm-hmm.
Are you yourself?
Well, I'm a Catholic, so and that to accept and claim membership in a community, of course, implies an adherence to basic principles of that community. That's a kind of basic social principle.
But another Catholic might sit down, pick up on all the things, the aspects that you've just pushed aside in this legacy, and say, no, those are the core.
But when you're talking about religion, you're also talking about the importance of internal assent, the assent of conscience. We're talking about God first, and we always speak about God indirectly. Mm. No one speaks directly about, for, or to God. Mm. We speak to God, about God, for God, using indirect language, the language of poetry, the language of the imagination. The language of theology is by definition imprecise. And when people attach a kind of precision to it, they're being much more like Enlightenment scientists than they are like religious people. And so having said all of that, I think that note of a certain ambiguity in doctrine, in belief, goes with the religious institution itself. It's true of Catholicism. I would argue it's also true of Judaism, Islam, because wherever you're talking about religion, you're talking about matters that are beyond anyone's ability to articulate absolutely and with clear definition. This is not mathematics. Mm-hmm. This is not science. So having said all of that, John Paul II has presided over a period of the church's life in which this phenomenon, too, has come to a kind of maturity. There was a time, you know, if I lived in the time of Martin Luther, I wouldn't be a Roman Catholic. I would have had to either I would have been expelled from the church, or I would have found myself unable to remain. Mm-hmm. That's not the case
now. No room
now.
For dissent then.
The church is a community of people who are all in pursuit of the truth together. When we look at these complicated issues of sexuality, when life begins, when life ends, we're a community of people who are trying to deal with these ambiguous and difficult questions together. So, A, we listen to the authority of the church. We have an obligation to take it seriously. And we have an obligation to inform ourselves fully and to allow our positions to be criticized. But finally, as the Vatican Council itself asserts, we are all beholden to our conscientious assessment of doctrine, belief, and practice.
A conscientious assessment, a community that have been for these nearly 27 years beneath a very hierarchically oriented pope of great strength. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tony is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Tony, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. One of the things we haven't talked about was the assassination attempt on the pope, I think back in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he actually forgave his attacker. And while we've been talking about the pope in geopolitical terms, this is a very powerful testimony to reconciliation and forgiveness. But I think this is a very valuable lesson for all of us.
Do you see it flowing into the pope's teaching against war? Do you see a connection there, Tony?
Well, I think against war, against capital punishment, against the importance of reaching out to people, even those people that want to hurt us. I mean, it's turn the other cheek. It's a classic, you know, classic example of that. And this is a man that did it with his own life on the line, not just talking in theoretical terms, but actually experienced the pain. And I don't think he was ever the same since the assassination attempt.
The pain and a very close brush with death from that attempt. Tony, thanks for your call, James Carroll. That's a very personal example.
It's a very important point. I would just add to the wise remarks that the caller made that the Vatican also chose not to pursue what they could have pursued, which was the suspicion that the KGB, through the Bulgarian secret police, had been behind the assassination attempt. It's not clear who the assassin was working with or for. And it was actually a very important thing that the Vatican chose not to exploit the conspiracy, exploit the ambiguity. There was a way in which the Vatican just let the event be the event. And I would only add that both Ronald Reagan and John Paul II were the beneficiaries of a huge, one could almost say, world outpouring of concern and even affection on the occasions of those two assassination attempts. Mm-hmm. And it was actually part of the bond that Ronald Reagan recognized with John Paul II.
We've just got a minute remaining, James Carroll. You say these two things, the rejection of war, the embrace of the Jewish people. Your words lay the groundwork for future changes that could well go beyond what this pope foresaw or even wanted. Like what?
Well, I would say a fuller notion that there's more than one way to God. Let me just end by reminding people about the most important moment of the pope's life, of his pontificate at least, which in my view was his referencing the Western Wall in the year 2000, the Western Wall in Jerusalem. Why was that so significant?
Standing there alone, praying.
Standing there alone. From the Gospels forward, Christians have believed that Jesus is the new temple.
Mm-hmm.
Because Jesus is the new temple, the old temple is discarded. Christians treated it with contempt for centuries. For a tragic time, the Temple Mount of Jerusalem was a garbage dump.
Mm.
Theologically, the Christian denigration of the temple was part of the proof of the truth of our claims. When John Paul II went there in 2000 and prayed, as a Jew would pray, without invoking Jesus, he reversed 2,000 years of Christian contempt for Jews, Judaism. There is more than one way to God.
There is a legacy. James Carroll, always great talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.